The C.J. Mountfort Centre is a resource centre for people of colour and Aboriginal peoples at the University of Guelph. This is where we all unite. The Mountfort Centre, located in McKinnon Room 54 and 55, provides a microwave, two computers and a fridge among other resources. The centre is a place to study, sleep or relax. It's a place for great conversation. If you want to vent, share experience, good or bad, this is the place for you. You meet great people, and it's just an overall awesome environment. Don't hesitate to drop in anytime before 10 p.m., and you're sure to meet a smiling face. For more information, call us at 519-824-4120, extension 56911, or visit us at www.uoguelph.ca/Mountfort or join our Facebook group.
Looking for a weekly fix of post-rock, experimental, ambient, or anything just plain out there, visit us in
A Distorted Reality. Each week, we'll be showcasing both new and old sounds from close to home and around the world. So tune in every Saturday night from 10 to 11 p.m. on CFRU 93.3 FM, or listen to us online at cfru.ca.
Action Read Community Literacy Center offers one-on-one tutoring and small group learning in reading, writing, math, and computers for adults aged 18 and over in Guelph. At Action Read, we help you identify what you're good at so you can work towards your goals. Learn skills to get the job you want, to work on personal budgets, creative writing projects, for test preparation, and to improve study skills. Our services are free and no referral is needed. If Action Read sounds like the place for you or someone you know, contact us at 519-836-2759 or visit us on the web at actionread.com.
You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph, and this is The Press Conference. Today on The Press Conference, part two of Moans and Loans, a program examining money issues facing post-secondary students. No conversation about student finances would be completed without talking about tuition, and there isn't a lot of good news going around these days. Figures from Statistics Canada and the federal government point to a trend of downloading more and more costs of education onto students. We'll talk to the chairperson of the Canadian Federation of Students about the impacts of increased costs on accessibility. And later in the program, a professor of psychology at the University of Waterloo investigating student saving habits reveals some startling information about how much or how little university students choose to save. Hello and welcome to the press conference. My name is Greg Beneteau and I'm the editor of thecanon.ca. We're going to skip the theme music this week because we only have a half an hour format for the next little while. For those of you who are new to the program, the press conference is a weekly current affairs show organized by thecanon.ca, your online community at the University of Guelph. For the next hour, we'll be interviewing guests, talking amongst ourselves, and playing a couple of good tunes to round it all out. Now, we're going to jump into our first topic right away. Last week, Moans and Loans focused on the financial services industry, that is, the banks, credit card companies, and payday loan businesses that angle for a share of students' hard-earned cash. We heard from two individuals with advice to share on how students can navigate these services without burning holes in their pockets. Of course, even if you've never set foot in a bank or never used an ATM, during your entire 4 years at university, chances are you're still feeling the pinch. And that's because the cost of education in Canada is rising. And education advocates say the financial stress is pushing students to the brink. According to figures released by Statistics Canada last week, tuition fees for undergraduate students rose by an average of 4% this year, outpacing the inflation rate of 1.8%. For the second year running, Ontario undergrads paid the highest tuition in the country. The average tuition rate was $6,307 this year for Ontario undergrads, an increase of 5.4% from last year. Compare that with the tuition paid by Quebec undergrads, which at $2,415 is the lowest in the country. Graduate students faced even higher tuition increases, with fees rising an average of 6.6% to $5,182 on average. Statistics Canada also found that additional compulsory fees to post-secondary institutions are increasing. These are fees paid for athletics, student health services, and student associations, and they rose to an average of $702 from $656 a year earlier, an increase of 7%. Now, all these figures might be a little bit mind-boggling, but the increased costs, combined with higher-than-normal unemployment rates for student workers this past summer, essentially means that student loan programs have been very much in demand. The federal government recently had to top up its Canada Student Loans program after higher-than-expected demand threatened to push the program past its legally mandated cap. The Government of Canada estimated that the total value of student loans owed to the federal government was expected to top $15 billion this fall. It forced it to add another $300 million to the program in order to help an estimated 50,000 students get loans. Student organizations like the Canadian Federation of Students have sounded the alarm that education costs are rising too much, too fast. They warn that unless something is done, the levels of debt will bankrupt students for a generation. Here to discuss the current situation and how to address it is Dave Molenheis. Mr. Molenheis is the National Chairperson of the Canadian Federation of Students, and we reached him in Ottawa. Good morning, Dave.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Not a problem. So, Dave, these figures that have come out in the last month have come fast and furious. Was the CFS at all surprised about increases in tuition fees or the level of student debt or that's being incurred on programs like the Canadian Student or the Canada Student Loans Program?
Well, I would say no to your first question and yes to your other on whether or not we were surprised. So, I mean, the policies in a majority of the provinces and for about 90% of students across Canada, the reality is increasing tuition fees. Policies on tuition fees in Ontario and moving westward are all on the upward tick. And looking out east where post-secondary education is the most expensive or traditionally had been up until Ontario came up the middle and claimed the first place position only a couple of years ago. We're seeing tuition fee freezes, but again, the majority of students, the reality is tuition's going up, and despite the best efforts of students working together across the country to try to do something about that, administrators, politicians, etc., all seem to be reliant on and non-committal to political leadership on this issue and seem to be favoring downloading the costs onto the backs of students and their families to pay for or to finance our public post-secondary education system. On the student debt front, we were actually surprised that at the last, what seemed like the 11th hour, the Canada Student Loans Program had to hit the panic button. And on August 20th, the minister had to make the regulatory changes by way of order and council to the act. So basically turned around to the Governor General and asked for amendments to the language to make enough room for enough money to be lent out through the Canada Student Loans Program. And that wasn't anticipated to happen until 2014 or 2015. Which is a serious problem, a planning problem on the part of HRSDC, Human Resources and Skills Development Canada, that runs the student loans program, and is indicative of the fact that because we've hit this recession, the savings capacity of families in Canada has been reduced to such an extent that more and more people have demonstrated financial need and therefore have to take a loan just to get in the front door of our colleges and universities.
Now, give me an idea of what it means when tuition is this high and student loans are being used so often. How much of a of a debt load are students being saddled with when they graduate, and how does it affect them in the long term?
Well, it's difficult to analyze because Statistics Canada isn't given enough of a mandate or the resources to be able to collect this sort of data in any measurable fashion that's able to guide policy effectively. We need to do way more in terms of data collection, and we're seeing government policy head in the opposite direction with respect to tracking student debt, as they just recently canceled the Youth in Transition Survey, which analyzes the effects that the post-secondary education system has on the economy and what individual students, what the results are, what the labor outcomes are post-graduation. So what we do know, though, from the previous information available from this survey is that student debt loads continue to climb. And there are different ways that you can measure it, but perhaps one of the most relevant ways to do it is to look at the costs relative to how long it takes to pay off and what kind of percentages students are looking to pay in terms of their monthly income. So when we're talking about student debt loads reaching mortgage-like proportions, we are at that stage, essentially, where we're seeing excessive amounts being charged to students in terms of repayment for their student loans. So this is where we get into the realm of 11% of your monthly income is going towards solely just paying down your student debt. And that's the reality that students with debt loads in excess of $25,000 are facing, and that's the new reality. Our debt loads in Ontario between $28,000 and $32,000, according to estimates, given the fact that there isn't enough data available. That's the reality. Whereas if you have a mortgage, generally speaking, you're paying about 8% of your monthly income. It's set aside to go towards mortgages. So the new reality are debt loads that meet or exceed, in a lot of cases, the same kind of debt stress caused by a mortgage. And that's simply too much for students to bear. And we see the real impact of these student debt loads. It has a real social impact. Students delay starting families, delay purchasing assets like a home, and that has a real impact in the economy.
Now, that's an incredible amount, 11% for debt loads in excess of $25,000. But what about students who are prospective university students who look at these figures and wonder about whether they're able to afford university? Do we have any information about how the costs of university affect accessibility?
Well, yeah, and there's been some research done. Again, it's starting to get a little dated now that that we have a government intent on ceasing data collection projects. But, research has been done into the phenomenon of debt aversion, meaning that those, generally speaking, on the lower end of the income spectrum are that much more likely to be debt averse. And what that means is they have a greater understanding of what their capacity to pay is. And if you're on the lower end of the income spectrum, the amount of money it costs to take you to vault you into, say, a higher income bracket is simply too much for that individual to bear. And so a judgment call is made, and the decision to not accumulate debt is chosen, and that individual is that much more likely to enter into the workforce and essentially not pass go and collect their $200, meaning they won't be in the higher income bracket as a result, which, generally speaking, when you end up with your college or university diploma, we're only really talking about, on average, middle income earners. There are very few, in fact, who benefit tremendously from their diplomas at the end of the day, because this is the new economic reality. Is we need more and more of the new jobs being created require some form of post-secondary education. A university or college degree is not the same value-added element that it used to be. It is now the new economic reality. It is nothing more than a foot in the door and a means to remain competitive in the job market at this point. So when we're talking about the cost-prohibitive nature of tuition fee increases and debt loads in excess of $25,000 and $30,000, We're really talking about shutting out the individuals on the lower income spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are critics who have commented in the aftermath of the release of these figures that universities cost a lot to operate, that this is a reality of the economic times, and that students who want to move up in the world and who want to have a university degree should expect to pay the costs. How would you respond to those critics?
Well, they need to try just a little bit harder to understand the math. The OECD has published a report explaining the obvious, and that is investments from the government into our post-secondary education system pay off in dividends by a factor of 1.5 to 1.7 times. So the return on investment for public spending in post-secondary education is entirely reclaimed and then some by way of bringing people, lifting people up into higher income levels, which generates greater tax revenue for governments. It means that people are more self-sufficient and therefore less reliant on the healthcare system, the unemployment assistance system, and are participating in the economy in a way that actually benefits in excess of the initial investment that governments are making. So this is an economic reality that goes all the way up and down, side to side. All of the perspectives on economics have to acknowledge that this is the case. And so it's just a matter of political will on the part of a government whether or not to finance university and college education to an extent that it is completely accessible and not reliant on ever-increasing tuition fees. That's the only way that we're going to be able to maintain a fully accessible system and ensure that we have standards of access that works for everybody, and so we can break cycles of poverty and do a heck of a lot more than what we're doing right now in terms of leveling the playing field for individuals.
We have about 30 seconds left, Dave. Just in the short term, what can be done to help offset or offload the costs from students of their education?
Well, I'll simply say that the budget is a living document. The Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, as well as the Federation and the coalition partners within that organization, have developed the alternative federal budget, which essentially lays out the program. It shows how it's just a matter of priorities. We just need to find the money in the budget and move it into the right places, and it'll pay off dividends. And we've already done that work.
Thank you very much for your time, Dave.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thanks.
Dave Mollenhuis is chairperson of the Canadian Federation of Students. We reached him in Ottawa. We're going to pause for a quick music break. The Sun Parlor Players are playing the E-Bar on Thursday, October the 14th. From their album Wave North, this is Make a Sound.
When you hear in the water, you feel like it's order, releasing your tension, the stress and disorder is big in America. Stephanie, Erica, both of them suffer from living in hurry, cause living is very competitive, hassling credit is hazardous, accidents, driving with negligence, too many beverages, people got too many things on their lettuces, TV's deadliest, professing the ugliest,
war,
what the hell you keep on killing me for, please won't you come and bend down low, let me tell you what little I know, and if it's worth some, spread it indeed, like shit and vomit that's under your feet, I was born in a pot boiling black and hot, waiting to be tasted and rapping. Alive. But justice would not come and eat my flesh. Instead, I had poverty to feed my stress. Until my life became an ode to the gun. Not needed like an overcoat to the sun. So I thought I was just made to exist. Not to live or change and resist. But fear will have you believe in fear. Paralyzed, have you believe in tears. This is the therapy needed, so use it. Music is water, you know what my proof is? People need music like they need excuses. People need water like Kanye needs Jesus.
Wash it down.
I know you're stressing. This is a little meditation for you to relax and jump in the pool and, you know, sink.
My people drum on water, drink on water, live on water, die for water. My people drum on water, drink on water, live on water, die for water.
That was not the Sun Power Players. That was Kanon. He's actually playing Peter Clark Hall this Sunday as part of a presentation brought to you by the CSA. And from his album, that was Wash It Down from his album, The Daily Foot Philosophies. That was supposed to be the ending tune, but that's okay. So we just had a chat with Dave Mollenheis, the Canadian Federation of Students chairperson, and he talked about how the costs of education are making it increasingly difficult for students to cope. But we need to ask the question, how much are students themselves doing to help save for the costs of education? A recently released study by researchers at the University of Waterloo looked at how good students are at saving money if given the opportunity. Here to talk to us about some of that research is one of the authors of the study. Professor David Kohler is a professor in philosophy at the University of Waterloo, and we reached him presumably in Waterloo. Hello, Derek.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. So can you just sort of go over how the study worked exactly? I understand that it involved giving co-op students the opportunity to save either by themselves or with help from a program. Can you sort of unravel how that worked?
Right, so we contacted students at the beginning, co-op students at the beginning of a work term, and invited them to participate in a study. And one of the things we asked them to do was to set a savings goal for the term. So most of the students, of course, are planning on saving a certain amount of money, and we asked them to kind of set a concrete dollar figure, how much of their income they were hoping to have saved by the end of the term for use in their, you know, the next study term. And then we asked people to make, the students make predictions about their likelihood. So how, what's the probability that you'll achieve this goal? And we found that the students were pretty optimistic. They said they were somewhere, they thought the probability was upwards of 80-85% that they would achieve their goals. And when we followed them up at the end of the term, we found that although it, the majority of them had achieved their goal, reported having achieved their goal, it was more like 65%. So had those predictions at the beginning of the term been accurate, we would have expected a larger proportion of students to have achieved their savings goal. So what that suggests, and is consistent with lots of findings in other areas, is that the students were kind of overly optimistic about their ability to achieve a goal that they held. Or in other words, they're overly optimistic that their future behavior will coincide with their, you know, current intentions to save.
Now, as the flip side to that, students were also given the ability to enroll in a program where money would be set aside for them, similar to how employment insurance sets aside for when...
Not exactly. We think of... We weren't able to do that in the study.
Oh,
but
you weren't?
What we did in the study was designed a simple intervention that, based on previous research, we thought would help the students achieve their goals, which is simply to monitor their progress. So every other week during the term, half the students who are assigned to that condition would check in with us, go to a website, and just answer two quick questions about how much they'd saved to date and whether they felt they were on track to achieve their savings goal. And even that kind of simple sort of reminder and kind of requirement that you continually monitor your progress toward the goal was helpful in the sense that at the end of the term, there was about a 10% a higher probability that students who received that program would achieve their goal than did in the absence of that. And what we were interested in was the students' ability to kind of predict or anticipate the kind of impact that simple intervention might have. And what we found is that basically the students at the beginning of the term didn't think it would make any difference. They didn't think that that service or that, you know, intervention would be helpful to them in saving.
And that was reflected in how much they would be willing to spend to enroll in such a program,
correct?
That's right. Okay.
That's right. So we ran a second study where we asked people, well, how much, you know, we described this service to them and asked them how much would they be willing to pay to receive it, and they basically said nothing. And the reason for that was because they didn't think they needed it. And, you know, it comes back to the idea that it's easy to kind of convince yourself to be kind of overly optimistic that what you'll do over the course of the term coincides with those good intentions you hold at the beginning of the term. So the link to what you were mentioning about, like, a bank product that, for instance, sets up automated weekly or monthly withdrawals to some sort of savings account is that that kind of takes the kind of steps required to engage in the savings behavior out of your hands. It kind of automates it for you. And it seems to us, and based on other research, that those kind of mechanisms, those kind of external mechanisms, can be surprisingly helpful in helping people to achieve long-term goals that they hold. But people often fail to appreciate how helpful they can be ahead of time, and we tie that to the idea that they're overly optimistic. It's just hard when you're thinking about how important it is to save money, because you really need it for the study term. It's just hard to imagine a scenario where you're not going to achieve that goal, right? It's important. Why? Of course, why wouldn't I save? And as a result of that kind of focus, I think people, not just students, of course, but people in general, tend to be surprised by the impact that simple little external interventions or mechanisms like an automated savings program can have on their ability to achieve their savings goals.
Now, we just did hear about how it's becoming increasingly difficult for students to make ends meet on their own, and so programs like Spend, like that would allow students to save their money towards their education costs seem quite important. But I'm wondering, in terms of the research that you've done, are students' abilities to understand how to save money better or worse than those of the general population? Is knowledge of how to economize sort of disappearing from this up-and-coming generation's abilities?
I'm not really aware of any evidence about that. I mean, I suppose it stands to reason that all else equal, younger adults will have less experience will have less knowledge just of what different savings programs are out there and so on. But I don't see any particular reason to think that the difficulties that we observed that the students in our study had in achieving the savings goals that they held are much different than, in the general population. It's certainly a pretty widespread problem with achieving savings goals, for instance, toward retirement and avoiding debt, for instance, credit card debt. That's certainly nothing that is restricted just to students.
Now, what can students themselves take from your research that might help them in their day-to-day lives?
Well, I think it's a matter of being aware of the fact that, you can have very good intentions to accomplish some long-term goal, but you need to be, look for opportunities to kind of structure your environment to make it easier to achieve those long-term goals, whether it's setting up a savings plan or, if you have kind of fitness goals and so on, anything you can do to kind of make the situation that you're in, make it easier for you to keep your behavior in line with those long-term goals is a good idea, and that the power of those kind of external factors is bigger than you might imagine.
Just a quick question before we wrap up, Derek. Is there any intention for you to do a follow-up where the system or the spending deferral savings program that you sort of developed is actually implemented and tested out on students at the university?
Not at present. I mean, down the line, it would be interesting to see some kind of program implemented through a bank, let's say, based on some behavioral research. And there's some of that going on in other countries. I'm not aware of how much of it is going on here, but at some point, I think that's really the natural next step, and we would need the right kind of partners to do that work.
Thank you very much for your time, Derek.
All right, thank you.
Derek Kohler is a professor of psychology at the University of Waterloo, and we reached him in Waterloo. We are just about out of time for today. Just a reminder to our listeners that Raise Your Voice, CFRU's annual on-air funding drive, runs from October 23rd to the 30th this year. I'll be hosting a special Raise Your Voice edition of the press conference with tons of special guests, so you won't want to miss that. Check out CFRU.ca for more details about the funding drive and how you can help support community radio in Guelph. A reminder that past episodes of the press conference are available for download online at www.thecanon.ca. Click on the local news link and scroll down to This Week on the Press Conference. We hope you'll join us next week for another show pulled straight from the headlines. I'm Greg Benintoe signing off with the actual Sun Parlor Players from their album...